Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. This program has the benefit of the uncommon and very impressive intelligence of Diana West, a longtime syndicated columnist. You can find her work these days at the Daily Caller and, of course, at her website, DianaWest.net. She is the author of two superb books, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal, and a regular feature of this program. We're always pleased to have her with us. Welcome back, Diana. Thank you.
Oh, well, thank you, Frank.
So, your thoughts, my dear, on the Iran decision of President Donald Trump yesterday?
That was score one for our side. That was fantastic to see the president fulfilling this very important campaign promise, because in terms of trying to write the world, which is a very big project, one of the important guides is not to enter into strategic treaties with countries that are openly avowed to your destruction. It doesn't work, and it hasn't worked. And we look at our long association and tragic association with the Soviet Union, and we see this not working every time, going back to 1933, when FDR normalized relations with the abnormal state. The Iran deal was another one of those iterations of trying to normalize an abnormal state and losing all in the process. So this was a very good moment.
Well, you mentioned a strategic treaty. This, of course, wasn't anything like a treaty. It wasn't written like a treaty. It wasn't considered like a treaty. It wasn't approved like a treaty. But your point is well taken. Even if it were, it would have been a misbegotten adventure, let alone this form, this political understanding, as John Kerry was finally compelled to reduce it to. Diana, the thing that made it such an important win for our side, as you put it, I think, is that it was a defining moment, and it shows in sharp contrast the American vision of the enemy we're facing and the need to do something practical and effective about it rather than paper it over on the one hand, and on the other, what the European allies are insisting we must do, which is to, well, keep propping these guys up and hoping against hope that despite the shortcomings of this so-called understanding, they'll behave rather better. And I just wanted to say, Diana, this reminds me, I don't know if you remember this as I do, but back in the day that Ronald Reagan was president of the United States, there was a kind of similar moment where he fought the Europeans over their insistence that they had to get hooked up to the then Soviet energy grid through the Siberian gas pipeline, as it was called. And Ronald Reagan, to his great credit, with help from some of our friends like Roger Robinson, fought them to a standstill and then ultimately prevailed. And the rest, as they say, is history. I think it was a very important factor in helping to bring down the Soviet Union that it didn't have the infusions of life support that the Europeans had in mind. And it's a message, I think, for this time, too. The infusions that the Europeans have in mind to support this horrific Iranian regime is an equally misbegotten idea and should be and is being, thankfully, resisted.
Absolutely. And it just speaks to the corruption of then and now and the motivations that we see in this kind of continuing corruption. I mean, this has to be money and deals and all of these things have to be the driving factor here, not self-defense, not national destiny, and all of these much greater questions that speak to survival. These people are so short-sighted.
You know, speaking of corruption, I have to say my working assumption is that that was operating in the negotiation of this agreement when the Europeans were complaining at the time, you'll recall, Diana, that the John Kerry-led delegation to these conversations with the Iranians and the Russians and the Chinese and the Europeans and so on was serving as lawyers for the Iranians, wringing concessions that the Europeans, even the Europeans, didn't think were warranted, for heaven's sake. Let me turn to one other thing that you've written about at your superb website, dianawest.net, and that is a piece you filed there about Marx's third century, perhaps in part triggered by this, I think it's an 18-foot statue of Marx, or his head that the Chinese communists have given to the town which he hailed from. Give us your reflections, Diana, on the bicentennial of Marx's birth and his horrible legacy to the world.
Yes, well, in many ways, I think this may be for Marx, his best birthday yet, because so much of his enterprises program has come to us by stealth and by hook and by crook. But in a nutshell, looking at that statue in Germany that is now standing in the center of this town of Trier, which is Marx's birthplace, it was an amazing, horrifying moment when, symbolically speaking, the president of the European Commission, the European Union body, Jean-Claude Juncker, went to Trier to praise Marx. So the president of the 500, theoretically, the 508 million people of Europe, site of the battlefields of cold and hot wars going back into history, goes to Marx's birthplace, praises him in a church where a cross is not visible, and this was the birthday party for Marx going into the third century. It says a lot about who won the Cold War, ideologically speaking, which, of course, is the whole shebang. And this, to me, was a terrible moment.
Yeah. And Diana, just as a serious student of history, tell us a little bit about Marx's bitter, if not really truly poisonous, fruit over the past 200 years.
Yes, well, this is the man who's, he's the would-be destroyer of God and morality and property and liberty. And he was the direct basis, the philosophical and political basis for the development of the communist dictatorships that killed, in a very conservative estimate, 100 million people in the course of the 20th century, as they were realized in dictatorships beginning in the Soviet Union, China, and on across the world.
The worst of it, arguably, being in China, which is, of course, the source of this statue to Marx.
Yes, and the source of thousands of tourists to Trier. I mean, this was an offer they did not want to refuse, and indeed the mayor of Trier is an enthusiast. The question becomes, where will the next statue of Marx go up?
It reminds us, again, of how short our memories are, and not least the thing that I think you've written about so brilliantly for so long is the extent to which this Marxist enterprise has penetrated and increasingly achieved the subversion of our own country. It's not just Bernie Sanders and his followers. It is really throughout our educational system, our culture, our media, and unfortunately, as Trevor Loudon has pointed out, yes, our churches, of course, but also our government, which is particularly chilling. This is a subject for our next conversation. I'm quite sure we will look forward to it greatly. Diana West, in the meantime, thank you for the great work you do, and thanks so much for especially American Betrayal and all that it teaches us about these characters and the danger they continue to represent. Keep up the good work, my dear. Come back to us again next week. Next up, we will speak with Kenneth Timmerman. We'll get his take on the post-Obama bomb deal and the possibility that there may actually be liberation from the mullahs in store for the people of Iran as a result. That and more, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It is a delight to be able to say that to our next guest. He is Kenneth Timmerman, the president and CEO of the Foundation for Democracy in Iran, on whose behalf he has done such important work that he was nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize, if you please. He is an investigative reporter of extraordinary accomplishments and the author of numerous fiction and nonfiction works, including one of my personal favorites, Dark Forces, The Truth About What Happened in Benghazi. He is a good friend of this program. We're always delighted to have him with us, especially on this day of days when we are celebrating what Donald Trump did yesterday as a step, we hope, towards actually ending the threat that Iran represents to not only its own people and its neighbors, but to us as well. Kenneth Timmerman, welcome back. I'm sure you're popping the champagne corks, as am I.
An incredible moment, Frank. It really is. We have a president of the United States who keeps his promises.
Mm. And on the hard things, Ken, I think that's the real crucible here, is that they haven't been the promises that are the sort of lip service that's easy to fulfill. These are a series of very tough challenges, especially given the pressure he's been under in this case to perpetuate the Obama bomb deal. Talk a little bit about something you wrote about recently at Fox News, that it was in fact necessary because the Iranians themselves had killed the deal.
That's right. This deal, Frank, you and I know and our listeners know, has been a fiction from the get-go. It has been based on a lie, a fraud, a fiction. It's been based on lies. The Israeli exposure of the Atomic Archive last week just brought this out again into the forefront. The Iranians were lying the very minute that they entered into the deal. They were lying while they were negotiating it. They did not disclose their previous military activities. In other words, their research and development of a nuclear warhead. And that's what they were supposed to give up, and they never gave it up. So really, this is the end of a deal that put Iran on a glide path to nuclear weapons, an arsenal of nuclear weapons in 10 years, and essentially opened up their economy for foreign investment. So European companies and even American companies like Boeing could prop up this rotten regime.
Yeah, and that's really the key piece of this, isn't it? That they were legitimated and enabled to get essentially the lobbying arms of all of these governments through their companies who were desperately anxious to make money. Some of it, the money that we had sent in exchange for them signing on to this lousy deal to prop up this regime. And so we have the spectacle now of the Europeans, some of whom actually, as I recall, Ken, and I'm sure you will too, complained rather bitterly that John Kerry, as the leader of the U.S. delegation negotiating this Obama bomb business, was acting like the lawyer for the Iranians, extracting concessions from them that they thought were ill-advised. You don't hear much about that these days, as they're professing their undying commitment to this accord. What role must we expect the Europeans to play in this going forward, and what should we be doing to dissuade them from that course?
Well, I think President Trump showed in the body language between himself and the French President Macron, when Macron was here for 3 days, that he's in charge. You're not going to see leadership out of Europe. You'll hear, excuse the phrase, and I don't really mean to be quite as demeaning as it sounds, but you're going to hear a lot of yapping dogs. And at a certain point, the yapping dogs will go quiet when they realize there's a big dog in town and they'd better just range themselves in the kennel. But Donald Trump has exerted leadership. The Europeans always respect American leadership. At the same time, they carp about it and they complain about it. The Europeans want one thing in Iran, that's to do business. The Germans want their companies in there. The French want to exploit the oil resources, as do the British. And they realize that by pulling out of the deal, the United States is saying, hold on there. We are not going to have massive Western investment into Iran. We're not going to be developing Iranian oil resources because that is only propping up this rotten regime. Instead, we want to give the people of Iran a chance. Listen to the end of the president's speech when he announced the end of the deal. It was all addressed to the people of Iran. And this is so important. The tone was so pitch perfect, Frank.
And they've waited a long time for this. And Ken, you know, I was thinking as you were talking, talk about a plan B. If the Europeans, who are so anxious to sell things to the Iranians, could just get their head around the possibility of doing that with a successor government that represents people who don't wish to destroy us, but want once again to be part of the international community, no kidding, and to enjoy the fruits of freedom themselves. This could be a very potentially lucrative opportunity for them, provided they don't keep this dangerous regime a going concern. And speaking of which, if I could just ask you to talk quickly about several things that are evidence of the dangerousness of this regime. There's, of course, the nuclear weapons program, which, as you say, Bibi Netanyahu exposed in much of its detail. There's the terrorism. There's the subversion of allies, neighbors, and the like. Talk about Lebanon, where there was just an election that brought to even greater power their proxy, Hezbollah. Ken Timmerman, how serious a problem is that, as you see it, for us as well as others?
It's a huge problem. Hezbollah now has an estimated 150,000 Iranian missiles, all of them aimed at Israel. And these are missiles that are getting more accurate every year. I was there on the ground during the last war with Hezbollah in 2006, and the northern third of Israel was a ghost town, was completely shut down for 6 weeks, for 2 months. It was had a terrible impact on the Israeli economy. Now, Israel is a very resilient country, and they bounced back quickly. But a Hezbollah missile strike on Israel today would be nothing like 2006. It would be 10 times more powerful. The Israelis realize this. Bibi Netanyahu was in Moscow on Wednesday, precisely to get the Russians to exert a moderating influence on Iran and on Hezbollah in Lebanon.
We're going to talk more with Mark Langfan in a moment about this Russian play and their interests here. But Ken, the difference, of course, from the time that you've just recounted, 2006, and today is those missiles in rockets in southern Lebanon, primarily, could range the entirety of Israel, could they not?
Yeah, absolutely. And they're far more accurate. I watched as missiles just barely missed the hospital in Haifa, old people's homes, big population centers. It was really like the angels of God, were there surrounding and protecting Israel.
This is what gives rise to a concern about an imminent outbreak of hostilities with the Iranians in Syria and as I say, these proxy forces. Ken, one other piece of this is, of course, the possibility that Hezbollah cells are now operating in this country. Some say for sure they're in Latin America and may be anxious to come here. But there's also this concern that some are here already. What do we know about that, and how serious a threat do you think that represents to us?
Well, the FBI has testified to Congress that they are tracking Hezbollah cells all across the United States. Every single one of their field offices is tracking Iranian covert cells. Just a week ago, Frank, a prominent Iranian dissident named Mansar Osanlu was apparently attacked in what seems to be an assassination attempt. A chemical weapon of some form was sprayed on his face, and he was beaten with a tire arm iron from behind by multiple assailants as he was going into New York City for an interview. I've written about this at Front Page Mag yesterday. It's on my website, kentimmerman.com. And this is the first time since 1981 that the Iranians have actually attacked a dissident here on U.S. soil. Very important.
Ken, just on some of the details of this are also very important. Just tell us who he was about to have an interview with and why that may point to, if not Hezbollah, certainly people aligned with the Iranian regime to carry out this act of terrorism.
Right. So he was going to have an interview with an outfit called Iran International TV. They are staffed by many people who used to work for Voice of America, but people who were fired from Voice of America because of their known ties to the Iranian regime.
Now, again, the Voice of America is a U.S. government funded outlet for broadcasting to places like Iran. You're telling me we had people tied to the Iranian government who were doing broadcasting for us, ostensibly?
And we still do, Frank. President Trump has not yet taken over Voice of America. It is run by anti-American people. There's a struggle going on the inside. There's some Trump people in there, but not enough. And the Persian service has been awful. It's been Voice of the Mullahs for many years.
Wow. All right. So just finish up the story. This fellow was going to be interviewed by people with ties to the Iranian government. presumably, therefore, people they may have been in touch with in Iran or their forces elsewhere would have had pretty good situational awareness about his, not only the time of his interview, but how he was going to get there and so on. So does this seem, as a ace investigative reporter, Ken Timmerman, like the makings of a crime that was the function of, well, to use the term much in evidence these days, collusion between this broadcaster and the government of Iran?
That we'll have to see what the FBI turns up, but the FBI is investigating this. They have visited with Mr. Osanlu in hospital. He was in a coma for nearly a week. They took his clothes to examine. They took his blood samples, vomit, to determine what form of chemical was sprayed on him. And he had told these broadcasters exactly when he was coming in, because they set a time for the interview, and how he was coming. And so he was attacked on the PATH train in public.
And you have actually spoken to Mr. Osanlu, is that right?
Yes, I spoke to him in the hospital not too long after he woke up from this coma.
A fascinating story. I know you'll keep on it. Ken Timmerman, thank you. God bless you for the work that you've been doing at the Foundation for Democracy in Iran, Ken Timmerman, and so much more elsewhere. Next up, we'll speak with Mark Langfan, as promised, about the Iran deal, yes, but also about the Trump strategy for Syria. That and more, straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We are joined by Mark Langfan, better known to some of us as the Map Man, because of his intrepid use of topographical maps and displays to help the rest of us understand some of the extraordinarily important contributions geography makes to the conflicts that have roiled the Middle East for so long. He is an astute observer of these matters, has written extensively on them. He is a great resource, and I'm always delighted to have him with us to talk about things on his mind that are on ours as well, especially on a day like today, when we are celebrating the end of the so-called Obama bomb deal. We are, I'm sure, toasting here, as are you there, Mark, this extraordinary accomplishment of President Trump and his national security team, his new national security team, let me emphasize. Your thoughts about the deal's demise and what comes next?
Well, first of all, Frank, thanks for having me. You have always been just the greatest stalwart supporter of a strong United States and a strong Israel. So I want to say God bless you and everything great that you do. On the Iran deal, I'd like to put this in context a little bit, in that if we were in World War II or a pre-World War II scenario, the best analogy to sort of understand what the Iran deal was essentially if Chamberlain had said to Hitler, listen, Adolf, put a pause on your nuclear bomb for 10 years, but you can take over the entire Europe conventionally. As long as you do it conventionally, I don't have a problem with it. And I'm going to pay you $150 billion to help you take over Europe conventionally.
Not a great deal, Mark, it would seem.
That is not, but that is in effect what Obama did. He said to Iran, listen, you can massacre 500,000 Sunnis in Syria. You can take over Yemen and the Red Sea. You can take over North Africa. You could take over everything, and I'm going to pay you $150 billion. Just put your atomic files in the freezer. And by the way, here's your $150 billion so that you can, meanwhile, have North Korea develop the nuke that you can buy from North Korea.
So President Trump stepped up and, having promised to get rid of this, as he called it, the worst deal in history, he's actually done it. And what comes next, as you see it, Mark Langfan, both in the region and perhaps beyond?
What comes next is, again, you know, if you go back to a World War II analogy, he's essentially saying, listen, I'm not going to let you invade Poland. I'm not going to let you run roughshod all over. I'm not going to let you assert conventional hegemony over the area. And that is, if you look throughout the Middle East, you'll see where the Iranian cancer has been spreading. And it is a multifaceted campaign that he has been pushing back at each juncture. And really, Syria is a critical puzzle piece in this entire mosaic of Iranian expansion.
Yeah. And Mark, I want you to talk a little bit about some of your thinking on this. You've written very lucidly about it at Aretz Sheva. But talk specifically about the strategy that you believe Donald Trump and Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis are now carrying out to address and check Iranian ambitions in this tectonic shifting part of the Middle East.
Well, to understand the rollback, you sort of have to go back, believe it or not, to Mitt Romney, where the two biggest jokes of the Romney-Obama campaign were the fact checkers who first said, when Romney said Russia was America's greatest enemy, Obama laughed at him, and then everybody sort of mimicked Obama. But the real key was Romney said that Syria was Iran's path to the sea. And believe it or not, there's a Washington Post fact checker article that mocked that assertion, when what Romney was in fact saying was exactly geographically and geopolitically correct. Syria is Iran's path to the Mediterranean Sea.
Yeah, and they've been hard at building a bridge across it now for some time. So what is it? Just get to what Trump and Mattis are doing to try to check that and how it's going.
What Trump and Mattis are doing is, in effect, trying to create a cordon that runs north and south through the eastern section of Syria, where you have Kurds and you have Sunni Arabs. And they're in effect trying to mimic the successful Petraeus campaign in western Iraq, where you took the natives and you supported them against Iranian hegemony. Obama pretty much destroyed that strategy by pulling everybody out.
And further emboldening the Iranians in the process.
Exactly. So Mattis took really what was the ashes of an Obama half-baked attempt to assist the eastern part of Syria, and he went really full bore in not only supporting them, but arming them and giving additional support all the way around, and has effectively created this north-south swatch of territory that has the critical hub of Tomsk down in the southern, southeastern part of Syria, which is in effect the break between the Iranian forces of Iraq and the Iranian forces in western Syria.
Yeah. Now, Mark, let me ask you a couple of things about this that are at the very least complicating, if not, you know, completely sabotaging this strategy, as you've described it. One is, it seems as though we've abandoned the Kurds, who are an important part of that pincer, or as you describe it, the scissors in the work. But the other, just to tie the two together and see what you want to say about both, because we're going to run out of time here quickly. The Kurds are being attacked by Turkey, and to the extent that Turkey is being regarded as an ally who must not be crossed, this would seem to counter the sort of strategy that you've argued is in play and is working, in part because Turkey is tied to Iran, of course. And I'd also like you just to say a word about the role Russia is playing in all of this as well.
Yeah, the real problem there with Tillerson, in that Tillerson basically was caving to everything that the Turks wanted. And there was a meeting that was a catastrophic meeting between Tillerson and Turkey, where basically he folded. Now, I think that has stopped with Pompeo, and I think it's being reversed.
And you don't see a sign that Mattis is on board with essentially appeasing the Turks because he doesn't want to lose our base at Irtsilik?
No, I do not think Mattis is going to cave. I do not think Madison, and I think it is going to be a flashpoint. But the real bear of this situation is the Russian bear, of course. And the real key on why Trump's strategy of cutting this Iranian superhighway down, you know, breaking it up, is if you look at World War II again and you say, well, okay, when Germany attacked Poland, a lot of people forget Russia attacked Poland with Germany. And it appeared when that attack first came that you had two victors, meaning you had a Russian victor and you had a German victor.
Essentially partitioning Poland between them.
They destroyed Poland between them, but then what happened was when Germany was strong enough, they attacked Russia. So the analogy here is, once Iran aggrandizes itself to this topologic superhighway running from Tehran all the way to the Mediterranean and firmly acquires it, it's not going to need Russia anymore. And so then it is going to be Russia that loses. So the real question is a recreation of what was the Persian Safavid Empire in the best interest of Russia? And the answer is no.
Yeah, no, not in ours, not in theirs, certainly not under the current management. Let me ask you quickly, because you are a close student of these matters, are you anticipating, particularly in the aftermath of the president's action, that there will be a war between Israel and Iran in light of what they've been doing in Syria, but also in Lebanon, and the increasing danger to Israel, existential danger of Iranian activities in both?
I think there might be a skirmish. I do not think that there is going to be the kind of war that like a real war. I mean, there could very well be a skirmish. There could be a firing of missiles back and forth a little bit. But I don't think there's going to be a real ground war, because I don't think the Iranians are going to be able to really mobilize a sufficient order of battle close enough to the Israeli border to actually engage in something that is what we would call a war.
Well, boy, from your, as they say, from your lips to God's ears, my friend, I hope that's right. I was just talking with Ken Timmerman about 150,000 missiles and rockets in Lebanon, and some are clearly coming into Syria as well. It seems as though they are getting the ability to range Israel from perhaps further removed. We have to leave it at that. Mark Langfan, we are hard out of time, I'm afraid, but there's so much more to talk to you about, and we look forward to having a chance to do that with you in the near future. In the meantime, check out marklangfan.com and also his writings at Aryutz Sheva. Mark, thank you for your time today and the great work you do, among other places, at Americans for a Safe Israel. Its chairman they're very fortunate to have you in that role. Thank you, my friend. Come back to us again soon. God bless you. Next up, Dr. Mark Schneider will give us an update, speaking of Russia, about Putin's super weapons.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We are joined by our duty expert on all things nuclear. He is Dr. Mark Schneider. For many years, he served in senior positions in the United States government as really the duty expert for the Defense Department, the State Department, and the National Security Council, especially on matters involving both enemy threats as well as the feasibility and actual results of efforts to contend with them through arms control. There's simply nobody better in Washington, as far as I'm concerned, in terms of the corporate memory that Dr. Mark Schneider brings to bear on these issues, and it's a great privilege as well as pleasure to welcome him back to talk about all of this in light of a rather stunning development with respect to arms control, namely, as we've been discussing throughout the program, the president's decision yesterday to withdraw from this so-called Iran nuclear deal. I call it the Obama bomb deal. Welcome back, Mark. Good to have you.
Oh, thank you very much.
So what did you make of what the president did and its implications for the practice of arms control more generally?
I thought it was the best arms control related decision in 30 years. It's exactly what Ronald Reagan would have done if he had faced the same problem, although the decision process went much more smoothly. We have decisively rejected placebo arms control, and we've substituted national security as our criteria. We are operating on the basis of reality, not liberal ideology on arms control and supposed global norms. The Obama decisions relating to Iran resulted in the worst arms control agreement in the history of certainly our century and the 20th century before it. It is not an agreement. It is literally an unsigned, non-legally binding policy statement. That's not me talking. That's the Obama administration description of what they agreed to.
A political understanding, I think, is what John Kerry actually was reduced to calling it at one point.
Well, yes, but that has no legal implications. The real bottom line is this thing was defective in every respect. First, the substance of it was terrible. It really placed no restrictions on the Iranians. Second, the verification regime was severely defective. There's no question that it will not prevent, would not have prevented Iran from obtaining nuclear weapons. And worst of all, they got $150 billion, a lot of it in literally currency, untraceable currency, with which to pursue their global Islamic agenda, fanatical terrorist agenda.
Yeah, Sharia supremacism, I call it.
Yes, but here we're talking about not only that, but nuclear weapons. And my guess is, and I think this really should be looked at seriously as they pursue the related negotiation with North Korea, there is a serious connection between North Korea and Iran on nuclear weapons. My guess is that Iran is going to buy a significant number of North Korean nuclear weapons, and now they have thermonuclear bombs to sell with the direct proceeds of this terrible deal. And there's no way to reverse that per se. I think you've got to pursue the negotiation, but you also have to pursue deterrence and defense, because I think the North Korea negotiation is going to fail. I don't believe that Kim has any interest in getting rid of his nuclear weapons. And if he does, if I'm wrong on that, I don't think I'm wrong. I think he'll sell a significant number of them to Iran. And that's a real problem.
Yeah. A fire sale if he has to get out of that business, perhaps. Mark Schneider, I remember from our time together in the Pentagon, an adage that our mutual friend and boss, Richard Perle, also known by his detractors as the Prince of Darkness at the time, but one of the smartest guys I know on these issues, called to mind the adage of Samuel Johnson about second marriages when he was discussing arms control. And he said that it was the triumph of hope over experience. And that certainly seems true with so many of these treaties. And you've done, I think, just an unbelievably important service to our country over the years, Mark, in documenting the myriad violations of arms control agreements by basically everyone we've entered into such deals with, at least on, in the hostiles side. And this calls to mind, and I want to just pivot here, if I can, to Vladimir Putin. And the prospects for the rather systematic violation of the New START treaty by the Russians, and thereby, I'm afraid, a further compounding of the national security challenges that we're facing at the moment, notwithstanding arms control.
Yes, there's no question there are large-scale violations underway by Russia on essentially every significant arms control treaty that they have signed and ratified. The New START treaty, we know less about that because the State Department under Obama really minimized any sort of public release of information. But I think there's a significant body of information, mainly from the Russian media, believe it or not, concerning significant probable Russian violations of the New START treaty. I believe the numbers they gave us at the end of the reduction period are completely phony. They're exploiting the inability of the United States to verify any of the numbers under the very defective New START treaty verification regime. There's simply no way you can do that.
And Mark, one of the things that's a feature of this, as you've written about in a recent article in Real Clear Defense, are the emerging class of what you call Putin's super weapons. Talk us through that quickly, if you would.
Well, Putin announced literally five new major Russian super weapons. That's essentially what he called them in his speech. Sarmat, heavy ICBM, most destructive missile in the world. Nuclear torpedo or nuclear intercontinental range torpedo or drone submarine. The nuclear-powered cruise missile. The hypersonic boost glide vehicle he called the Avangard, and the Kinzhal, which he called a hypersonic missile. These are all new and very significant Russian systems, but the fact that they're new is not the most important thing. The most important thing is how they fit into literally 20-plus years of modernization that have been involved now about 25 announced Russian nuclear modernization programs.
Yeah, now, wait a minute. Let me just ask you to repeat that. How many new strategic weapon systems have the Russians been developing and in the process of now deploying?
If it's deployed, it's probably about 10. If it's announced, the development of it's around 25.
And that compares to how many U.S. missile systems and bombers and submarines?
Zero, literally zero. It's more notional now, thank God. But we have a modernization program that will introduce replacement systems between roughly 2025 and 2031. There are four of them. Only two of them are under contract. There is not the slightest comparison between what we are doing and what the Russians are doing in nuclear modernization. They're bending metal. They do it every day. We are not yet. We won't start constructing the first Trident replacement submarine until about 2020. Fortunately, there's been a slight speed up of the U.S. modernization program, and the Nuclear Posture Review and the House Armed Services Committee has taken action to speed up two of the four U.S. Replacement systems. That's good news. There's also a lot of other good news in the NPR about deterring Russian low-yield nuclear attacks, deterring their first use of nuclear weapons.
But we should be clear, Mark Schneider. These are steps that are being taken on the cheap, basically, and over a very long period of time, even if they're somewhat foreshortened, at a moment when we're watching this wholesale upgrade of the Russian capabilities, including with some very threatening systems and some violations of the treaty obligations that they have made to us in the past, a lesson to be learned from what President Trump has done here. Mark Schneider, again, I can't thank you enough for the work you've done over your entire career. Come back to us soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.